Welcome to the Continuing Education webcast, New Antiretroviral Agents, with Dr. Joseph Aaron. This program is jointly sponsored by the Annenberg Center for Health Sciences and Claris Health. It is supported by an independent educational grant from Bristol-Myers Squibb. To receive continuing education credit for this activity, participants must complete the program evaluation and post-test, which can be found on the main activity page at the Body Pro.
Great. Thank you very much. Hi, this is Joe Aaron, and welcome everybody who's taken the time out to listen to this presentation tonight on new antiretroviral agents. I'm going to focus on the treatment experience patients and try to make it case-based. We'll kind of talk through a case, and I'll try to show you the data as it applies to this case. But I would encourage all of you to feel free to ask questions. You can type them in, as was mentioned during the talk, and they'll show up on my screen, and I can answer them out loud, or I can hold on to them to the end of the talk. So, but go ahead and feel free to type them in. I also have some questions during the presentation that I'll poll you with. I'll send out a little poll, and you can answer that, I hope, and we can have a discussion about your answers if you like. So the first slide just starts to talk about the case, and this is a 50-year-old African-American man who's been HIV positive for a little over 12 years. It's important to know that he presented with a low CD4 cell count and with pneumocystis, and his medical history includes pancreatitis, diabetes, elevated triglycerides, high blood pressure, and obesity. His treatment history includes experience with multiple nucleoside analogs. He was a victim of full-dose ritonavir back in the day. He received indinavir, sequinavir, ritonavir, and lopinavir, ritonavir. He also was treated with two NNRTIs, not together, but over the course of his therapy, and had clear virologic failure on one of the NNRTIs, nevirapine, and he also received enfuvirtide for 6 months in 2005, and he stopped secondary to an ISR, which is an injection site reaction, but at the time he stopped, he had low-level viremia. Since January of 2005, he's been on essentially kind of a holding regimen. He's been on atazanavir, ritonavir, tenofovir, FTC, and a fixed-dose combination, and abacavir. You can see in July of 2005, his CD4 cell count was 150 with a viral load of 18,000. And then 2 years later, he'd had a decline in his CD4 cell count down to 114, and his viral load was 25,000, so up slightly, but probably not much different. The most recent genotype, which was drawn around the time of the CD4 and viral load, show multiple thymidine analog mutations, including the 41L, 210W, and 215Y. So those are the thymidine analog mutations. But he also has evidence of resistance mutations to DDI, which is the 74V, and the M184V mutation, which suggests resistance to 3TC and FTC. He has two NNRTI mutations, and he has a long list of protease inhibitor mutations that kind of correlate with his long history of protease inhibitor treatment. So I have, at this point, a couple of questions for you, and we'll take them one at a time. The first question is just, is it time to change therapy in this patient? So I'm going to send out the poll to you, and you can go ahead and tally your answer. Go ahead and click yes, no, or we need more information, and that'll give us a minute or two, and we'll come back with the answer. I'm sending the results out to you. I'm hoping they're going. But I think most of you, most of the audience said we really need more information. I think in general, I think we all feel like it is, this patient has a low CD4 cell count. It's kind of fallen over the past couple of years. We don't really know clinically. I haven't really given any information on how the patient is doing clinically, but I think all of us have the sense that it's probably time to change therapy in this patient. But I think in order to change therapy, we really need to know a little bit more information. We really need to know what are our treatment options. So this gets us to the second question, which is, what is your realistic treatment goal for a new regimen in this patient? So I'm going to send out the poll to you again for this question. What is your realistic treatment goal for this patient? The first choice is to suppress viral load to less than 50, avoid resistance, and improve CD4. Or the second choice is to kind of maintain clinical stability and preserve CD4 cell count. So go ahead and vote again. I'll give you like a minute or two. I'm just sending the results out to you. So two-thirds of us felt like the goal is to suppress less than 50, and a third of us thought, well, you know, this patient has quite a bit of resistance. Perhaps the goal is just to maintain clinical stability and preserve CD4 cell count and accept some viral replication. And I think that, you know, 2 years ago, B was the right answer. I think now, choice A is the correct answer, and it's reflected in the both the DHHS guidelines and the IAS USA guidelines, where really with our new agents and what I'm hopefully going to talk to you about, it really is time. We are really at a point where for even our most treatment experienced patients, like this gentleman, we have the potential to get the viral load to less than 50 copies. And in fact, I see it as a giant responsibility. We as HIV clinicians really have a huge responsibility to these patients to actually get it right, to get them less than 50 copies. In part because of the new agents that we have available to us. So the third question in a row here is which new protease inhibitor is likely to have activity for this patient? And remember, there was quite a long list of protease inhibitor mutations. So I'm going to send you this question and go ahead and answer it. But to be honest with you, if you gave me that long list of mutations had to give you the right answer, I would need to actually get a little bit more information. So go ahead and vote, though. Do the best you can, and we'll actually go over it, and we can see, you know, what the best choice might be in this setting. So I'm going to send you out the results, and you can take a look. And what you can see is that most of us thought that darunavir-ritonavir was going to be active. And if you guys are real good, which you may well be, you have your IAS-USA card and you're able to count the mutations. And then the next biggest group thought, well, perhaps neither drug is likely to have much activity. There's certainly a long list of mutations here. And I think, however, you know, even people as smart and knowledgeable as John Mellors or Dan Karitzkis or one of these, you know, resistance mavens, I think we have trouble just looking at that list and coming up with which of these two protease inhibitors is likely to be more active. And there really are two ways to get at this. And the first way to get at it is to know what mutations are associated with resistance. So each of the drugs, both tipranivir and darunavir, the investigators have worked out resistance scores, so essentially mutation counting. And while mutation counting may not be the most precise way to decide whether you have resistance, it actually turns out to be a pretty good way. So here on this next slide, slide number six, we're looking at the tipranivir score, and across the top, just below the title are the tipranivir resistance mutations. And what you can see is this patient has seven tipranivir resistance mutations. And if you look, at the results of from the RESIST 1 and 2 studies, you can see when a patient has 6 or 7 of these tipranovir resistance mutations, the likelihood that they're going to have a very potent antiviral effect is actually quite low. And the median fold change, the level of resistance that they'll have to tipranovir is relatively high. There's a more recent publication from John Baxter in the Journal of Virology that suggests that in part these data are influenced quite a bit by the partner drugs that one is able to administer along with tipranovir. And in the RESIST studies, which were done, you know, earlier than some of the other data that I'll show you, the number of active partners was actually relatively low. But in this case, this patient has 7 tipranovir resistance mutations, and I think it's really not very likely that tipranovir is going to have potent activity in this patient. So what about darunavir? I think the good news about darunavir and tipranovir is they really don't have highly correlated cross-resistance. You certainly can find viruses that are cross-resistant to both tipranovir and darunavir. On the other hand, there are viruses that are pretty highly resistant to tipranovir that are sensitive to darunavir and vice versa. So on this next slide, slide number 7, you can see that the patient actually only has 2 darunavir resistance mutations. And you can see that if you look at the bottom left-hand side of the slide, these are from the POWER studies, and it's looking at the proportion of patients that achieved a viral load less than 50 copies at 24 weeks. And you can see that you know, patients that had no darunavir resistance mutations, almost 2/3 of them achieved a viral load less than 50, whereas if they had 2 darunavir resistance mutations, the activity was somewhat less, but still 40% were less than 50. And if you had 3 or 4 darunavir resistance mutations, you really saw a substantial diminution of activity. So the folks who thought that darunavir ritonavir would retain activity in this patient were probably correct, at least based on counting mutations. So, but on the other hand, is it likely that darunavir is going to have full activity? That I'm not so sure about, because already there's the beginnings of darunavir resistance. The next slide just shows you the data from the combined POWER studies that were presented a year ago, a little bit over a year ago in Toronto. And you'll remember in the POWER studies, these were randomized studies, POWER 1 and POWER 2, of highly treatment-experienced patients who were randomized to receive darunavir-ritonavir or a comparator protease inhibitor plus optimized background therapy. And it's really this study that led to a large part to the change in the treatment guidelines, because what you can see in this particular slide is that those patients who were randomized to darunavir-ritonavir at a dose of 600-100 BID, which is the approved dose, you can see that about half the patients achieved a viral load less than 50, and that viral load suppression was sustained through 48 weeks, compared to only 10% of patients who received a comparator PI. So I think what we've learned from the POWER studies and from the RESIST studies is that even patients with substantial protease inhibitor resistance, there is the potential to get their viral load less than 50 copies. But I would argue that that while 46% or 50% is quite good, that may not be as good as we can get it in these highly treatment experienced patients. We can probably do better. Next slide is 2 more questions. So we'll go to our poll, which I'll send out to you. So the fourth question is kind of what would you do at this point? And you're given 4 alternatives. 1 is continue the current therapy. 2 is change therapy to zidovudine, tenofovir FTC, darunavir, ritonavir, and infuvertide. The 3rd choice is stop all therapy. And the 4th choice is get more information and perhaps use novel agents. So go ahead and vote. I'll show you the results and I'll go over them. And it's a really interesting split. So 25% of you would continue current therapy. And I think at this point, depending on what drugs you have in hand, that may be the appropriate thing to do. Almost 40% of you would get more information and perhaps use novel agents. And then another 40% would change to zidovudine, tenofovir FTC, drunavir, ritonavir, and infuvertide. And I think while in medicine there are commonly no right answers, I think that choice is probably not the best choice, because you'll remember that the patient in his history had experience with infuvertide, and while the patient stopped because of injection site reactions, the patient had a detectable viral load while on infuvertide. And what you can see in this next slide, and I'm going to go back, but in the next slide, this is looking at from the TORO studies, which were obviously done quite some time ago. But this is looking at patients infuvertide IC50 at baseline on the top line, which is the blue histogram. And at baseline, there's a pretty good spread of infuvertide susceptibility. But what you can see is that patients who have a virologic rebound, detectable viral replication while on infuvertide, that's the lower line, you can see this kind of dramatic shift and emergence of infuvertide resistance. And infuvertide really is a little bit like efavirenz or nevirapine, where you actually see in patients who have virologic rebound or detectable viral replication on infuvertide, the likelihood that they'll develop resistance is quite high. And Dan Karitskis and Steve Deeks have shown that even if the patient goes off infuvertide for weeks or months or even longer, when you reintroduce infuvertide, you rapidly reselect for a resistant virus. So in the case of our patient, probably choice number two is really using one fully active agent, then partially active nucleosides, and infuvertide, which is likely not to provide the support you need for the darunavir. So I'm going to go back and pull one more question and then kind of get into the new agent data, which is if you now have this patient and you know you want to switch therapy but you don't know what to do precisely, what additional tests would you order? Would you order a phenotype? Would you order a tropism assay? Would you get both or neither at this point? You guys are quickly voting on this one, and I think we have a pretty good consensus. I'll show you the results. But basically everybody would get both tests. And while, you know, there may be a cost issue, there may be an access issue in terms of your clinic, I think if you can have this information, it really is quite helpful to have both a phenotype assay and a tropism assay. So slide number 11 just reminds us that in today's world, the goal, even in our most highly treatment-experienced patients, is to suppress the viral load less than 50. And while I think darunavir would have pretty good activity in this patient, I think that we probably need more than darunavir to have a high likelihood of suppressing virus in this particular patient. If we look at the phenotype in this patient, you can see that even though there are multiple TAMs, there's not a very high fold change to zidovudine or retrovir, and that's in part because there were two AZT sensitizing mutations, the 74V and the 184V. But you can also see that tenofovir, despite the fact that the patient is still on tenofovir, probably still has some residual activity. And I think most of us in this next regimen would probably include a nucleoside analog. On the other hand, if you look at the conventional or the first generation NNRTI, really there's high level resistance with a 103N and a 181C mutation. And then if we look at the protease inhibitor susceptibility, I've kind of highlighted the darunavir, ritonavir, or Prozista. You can see that the range of susceptibility, the lower cutoff is 10, the upper cutoff is 90. So the patient did have two darunavir resistance mutations, so the fold change is not zero. The fold change here is 7.4, but that would fall in the, quote, fully susceptible range. On the other hand, you'll remember there were seven tipranavir or Aptivus mutations, and while there might be partial activity of tipranavir, ritonavir in this case, the fold change is very close to that upper cutoff. So those of us who were kind of guessing or counting mutations, I think the phenotype confirms that the darunavir, ritonavir is likely to be the more active of our novel or new protease inhibitor regimens. So this is just a summary. This is the current treatment regimen, reminding you of the viral load and CD4 cell counts, and you now have maraviroc and raltegravir approved. Etravirine, which is a second-generation NNRTI, may be available through you to you through expanded access, though I don't know for sure. There's I think, a strong likelihood that etravirine will be an approved drug sometime early in 2008. So what are the data for these new drugs? And now, you know, let's look at the data. In terms of the new agents from the new classes, we have the CCR5 inhibitors, and I'm going to focus on maraviroc because that's an approved drug at this point. As all of you probably know, HIV enters the CD4 cell by first binding to the CD4 receptor, but then in order to enter the cell, it has to bind to one of two second receptors, either CCR5 or CXCR4. So this cartoon shows you kind of a schematic of what the virus sees as it might be entering a cell. And there are, in, to my mind, really two types of virus. There are really three, but I think you can lump them in two categories. First, they're the R5 viruses, and these are viruses that really utilize only the CCR5 co-receptor. And back in the day, these were known as the non-syncytium-inducing phenotype. These are the viruses that are most frequently the transmitted virus. So patients are 99% of recently or acutely infected patients are infected with R5 viruses. And they're prevalent in early disease, depending on, you know, when you look in the patient's treatment history. And then the second group of viruses is really made up of two. They're dual tropic viruses, and those are viruses that can use either R5 or X4, and they're X4 viruses that can only use X4. And what these viruses use CXCR4 co-receptor. Of course, the dual tropic viruses can use either one. These are the syncytium-inducing phenotype. They emerge later in disease and up to about half the patients. And when they do emerge, they're associated with an accelerated CD4 decline and with disease progression. So remember these two types of virus. In early studies of maraviroc, we learned that maraviroc really does not have antiviral activity in patients who have either dual tropic or X4 viruses. There really was no advantage improvement in viral load over placebo when maraviroc was given to patients with dual tropic or X4 viruses. It probably didn't cause harm, and there's a question about this that's kind of pending here. But I think that one needs to carefully think about how to use maraviroc because you want to count on it to be a fully active agent. So in the phase 3 trials, which were called MOTIVATE 1 and MOTIVATE 2, these were patients that were triple class experienced. It was a 1-to-2-to-2 randomization. So patients had a resistance test done at baseline. They were stratified by whether they were going to use Invivertide or not and their baseline viral load. They were then randomized to receive optimized background therapy, which was selected by their investigator and their clinician, and then they were randomized to either placebo or one of two doses of Maraviroc, 150 milligrams once daily or 150 milligrams twice daily. And there are some subtleties about the dosing of Maraviroc. These patients all had to have R5 virus by a tropism assay at baseline. So these patients had R5 only virus. And it's important to remember in this study, when it was started, there was no darunavir-ritonavir available. So in this particular study, there was no darunavir-ritonavir in background therapy. Patients were allowed to receive tipranavir-ritonavir, and a small proportion of patients did receive tipranavir-ritonavir. The next slide shows you the basic results of the study. And these patients were highly treatment experienced with highly resistant virus. And you can see that those patients that received Maraviroc at either of the doses, either the QD or BID dose, had a substantial virologic suppression. So approximately 45%, if you look at both studies, Motivate 1 and Motivate 2, had less than 50 copies at 24 weeks. And in Motivate 1, the data were shown at ICAC by Jay Lalazari. If patients suppressed to less than 50 at 24 weeks, then that activity was sustained out to 48 weeks. And in fact, Motivate 2, which is on the right-hand side of the slide as you look at it, shows the 24-week data, but actually the 48-week data were also presented in the EECS meeting, the European AIDS meeting in Madrid, and again showing sustained activity out to 48 weeks. So I think clearly demonstrating that Maraviroc, when given to patients with R5 virus, clearly has a substantial activity. But again, we're looking at around 50% or a little bit less, and we're talking about trying to do better than that, and I think that's where we really want to combine active agents. And the next slide gives you a clue showing you that this is the proportion of patients less than 50 copies at 24 weeks. This is the combined analysis of Motivate 1 and Motivate 2. Green is placebo. Gray is Maraviroc Q-Day with optimized background. Dark blue is Maraviroc twice daily with optimized background. And what you can see is the more active drugs that are in the regimen, the more likely it is that the patient will suppress to less than 50 copies. And with two additional active agents, you see that with Maraviroc plus two additional agents, you get up around the 50% range. Having three or more active agents, you don't see a dramatic improvement in response, though the overall response is now closer to 60%. And some people have taken this to mean that, well, really all you need is three active agents in treatment-experienced patients, and that's probably correct. Though, again, I worry a little bit about, if 60% are less than 50, that means 40% are not less than 50. And those that are not less than 50, those patients are at risk for selecting for a dual tropic or X4 virus. So how often is Maraviroc going to be useful in our highly treatment experienced patients? These are data on co-receptor prevalence from a variety of different studies. The top three studies are in treatment naive patients, and you can see that roughly 80 to almost 90% of patients who are treatment naive have R5 only virus by the tropism assay. On the other hand, as you look at more and more experienced patients, the likelihood that patients will have R5 only virus declines. And in the highly treatment experienced patients, it's around 50% will have R5 only virus. And I think a really important point is that like every test, the tropism assay is not perfect. The tropism assay that was used in this particular study, probably somewhere between 5 and 10% of the time, misclassifies patients. So in other words, they'll be listed as R5 or determined to be R5 on one tropism assay, and then you'll repeat that same assay 4 weeks later, and about 5% of the patients in the MOTIVATE study actually had a switch or an emergence of X4 dual tropic virus, what we call dual mixed virus, before they ever experienced any maraviroc therapy. So about the current assay probably miscategorizes patients because of minority variants about 5 to 10% of the time. Now, there's a newer version of the assay that's coming online that is more sensitive and is less likely to misclassify patients. So what about the integrase inhibitors? So there are two integrase inhibitors, raltegravir, which was recently approved, and elvitegravir, which is still in development. I'm going to focus on raltegravir, which is also known as Isentress. HIV integration is a multi-step process. Obviously, there's viral DNA synthesis by the reverse transcriptase. That viral DNA moves into the nucleus and has to be integrated into the host DNA. It has to be integrated into the human chromosome in order for the virus to complete its life cycle. So if the virus doesn't integrate, it doesn't replicate. And the important step in integration is this strand transfer. And it was Daria Hazuda and her colleagues at Merck that demonstrated clearly that if you inhibit strand transfer, you can inhibit integration. And you have, if you inhibit strand transfer, you end up with an active antiretroviral agent. And in fact, all of the integrase inhibitors that are in development, either in clinical development or in preclinical development, the effective ones right now are all strand transfer inhibitors, and raltegravir is a strand transfer inhibitor. So what are the data on raltegravir? Well, there were two studies, Benchmark 1 and Benchmark 2, and you might see, you know, there's a trend here. We had Toro 1, Toro 2, Resist 1, Resist 2, Power 1, Power 2, and then we just saw Motivate 1 and Motivate 2. Well, this is Benchmark 1 and Benchmark 2. And this was raltegravir in highly treatment-experienced patients. Patients had to be triple-class resistant. They had to have a viral load greater than 100,000. They had a resistance test at baseline, which was a Phenosense GT, so they got both phenotype and genotype. Investigators were then allowed to pick optimized background, and then patients were randomized 2-to-1, so twice as many patients received raltegravir at 400 milligrams twice daily compared to placebo. So again, highly treatment-experienced patients. These patients, if darunavir-ritonavir was available, could receive darunavir-ritonavir in this particular study. And the benchmark study really, for our highly treatment-experienced patients, I think kind of sets the bar for getting patients less than 50 copies. So in the benchmark study, you can see now, and 24-week data were presented at the EECS meeting in Madrid just a month and a half ago or so, and basically a little over 60% of patients in the two studies were less than 50 copies at 24 weeks. So this is the kind of result, you know, we saw in the original treatment-naive studies when we were first using triple combination therapy. So with raltegravir, we have a very, very active drug that contributes to suppression in these highly treatment-experienced patients. And I think the other important point here is that with raltegravir, raltegravir is likely to be active against really any virus in our patients, provided that they're integrase inhibitor naive. But again, the same lesson comes across in the benchmark study. This is just looking at the proportion of patients responding based on the number of active agents in addition to raltegravir. Now, this is looking at less than 400 copies, not less than 50 copies at week 16, but data have now been presented with the less than 50 copy essay at 24 weeks. And if you just go to the GSS, so GSS stands for Genotypic Susceptibility Score, you can see that a GSS of 0 means there were no fully active agents in the background. And you say, whoa, 57% were less than 50 copies at 16 weeks. That's terrific. Less than 400 copies at 16 weeks. But again, that means that 43% worked. On the other hand, if there were two or more active agents in the background, then almost 90% of patients were less than 400 copies at 16 weeks. And in fact, if you look along the bottom, if patients receive both, if patients receive raltegravir, darunavir, ritonavir, and T20, then 98%, 43 out of 44, were less than 400 copies at 16 weeks. So not a big number of patients, but really a very impressive result if we combine fully active agents. This next slide looks at the less than 50 copy results. This is, again, looking at patients who received enfuvirtide and darunavir and raltegravir. So that would be the green line in the second set of histograms as you move histogram bars as you move down the slide. And you can see at 16 weeks, almost 90% of patients received raltegravir, enfuvirtide, and darunavir. So three fully active agents. These were patients who were naive to enfuvirtide and naive to darunavir. You're really getting up there, not 90% less than 50. And that's really what our goal should be. If patients used either only enfuvirtide or only darunavir, you can see it's more like 70%. Again, a good number, but we can do better. And if they use neither enfuvirtide or darunavir with raltegravir, you see actually a bigger splay. You see a better, a greater difference between placebo and raltegravir, but the proportion less than 50 goes down to 61%. Again, emphasizing the importance of combining multiple active agents. And on this next slide, really, I think is perhaps one of the most important slides. It's not projecting perfectly here, but this has to do with integrase inhibitor resistance. And the first two bars are for raltegravir. And the first bar is from the phase 2 study. And what it's telling you is that there were 38 patients who in the phase 2 study had a rebound in viral load while on raltegravir that had a genotype, that the investigators were able to do an integrase genotype. And what you can see is that 35 out of 38 developed integrase inhibitor resistance. The second bar is for the benchmark studies. There were 47 patients that had virologic failure at the time of this analysis. 41 had a genotype available, and again, 32 out of 41, or 75%, had integrase inhibitor resistance. And I think the really important point here is that while raltegravir is a potent drug that leads to suppression, especially when combined with other active agents, in our treatment experienced patients, if we choose wrong, if we don't fully suppress the virus, then the likelihood that the virus will acquire integrase inhibitor resistance is actually relatively high. Most of the patients have multiple mutations, so you can argue whether there's a low barrier or a high barrier to resistance. Most actually have more than one mutation. But the point is if you have rebound on raltegravir, it is likely that you'll see integrase inhibitor resistance. And then the next slide is looking at L-vitegravir and raltegravir. These are in vitro assays, but basically showing you that for the most part, if a patient's virus develops resistance to raltegravir, the likelihood that that virus will be cross-resistant to L-vitegravir is actually pretty high. So unfortunately, it looks like there is at least a substantial risk of cross-resistance amongst the integrase inhibitors that are currently either approved or in development. The red bars along the front is a Merck integrase inhibitor that's in preclinical development, so hasn't yet been given to humans. So my final set of slides before we get to our last question are dealing with etravirine. And etravirine is a new drug in an old class. So etravirine is an NNRTI, and again, there were two studies, Duet 1 and Duet 2, and much like the Benchmark and Motivate studies, these were very highly treatment-experienced patients. In fact, these patients had to have three or more primary PI resistance mutations. So these are the most resistant patients that have been studied to date. And these patients also had to have at least one NNRTI mutation, either at screening or documented in a previous genotype. And there were 600 patients per trial. So when looking at combined analysis, we're talking about 600 patients per treatment arm. The 48-week study with an extended follow-up, the primary endpoint was at 24 weeks, and the primary endpoint was the proportion of patients less than 50 copies. And you can see that in this next slide, these are the combined endpoint for both studies. And you can see, again, about 600 patients in each treatment arm. And you can see a statistically significant and, I think, important increase in the proportion of patients less than 50 copies. So, again, we're getting up to about 60% of patients less than 50 copies at 24 weeks. And the 48-week data will likely be presented at CROI. And in this particular study, all of the patients received darunavir-ritonavir. So all of the patients received darunavir-ritonavir. Half of the patients received etravirine or TMC-125. The other half received a placebo. And you can see that the placebo arm, you know, 41% less than 50, is very similar to the POWER study that we kind of started this presentation out with. So clearly, etravirine adds a substantial benefit. And again, it's kind of beating the point across is if you add additional active agents, and I'm sorry that the slide didn't maybe come through as well as it should have, that this is by PSS, so the top bars are PSS of 0, so 0 fully active agents. The second is a PSS of 1, and the third is a PSS of 2 or greater. And what you can see, again, this incremental increase, so where you have at least three active drugs in the background, in the regimen, so etravirine plus at least two other active drugs, you're getting up to almost 75% of patients less than 50 copies. And that is really the goal for our treatment experienced patients. And what about resistance to etravirine? There are mutations associated with etravirine resistance. Some of them are familiar to you. For example, Y181C is a relatively common NNRTI resistance mutation. The G190A is also a relatively common resistance mutation. And what you can see is if there are no etravirine resistance mutations at baseline, then the proportion of patients that get less than 50 copies is upwards of 70%. And you do see a modest decrease in activity with one etravirine resistance mutation, but you really don't see a dramatic decrease in activity until there are three or more etravirine resistance mutations. So one, I think, again, because this is a new drug in an old class, there is some risk of cross-resistance. And right now we're kind of stuck counting mutations. We don't have phenotypic cutoffs yet for etravirine. And it's important if you're already using etravirine and expanded access that you know these mutations and that you keep in mind that the presence of certainly two or three or more of these mutations are going to diminish etravirine activity to some extent. So let's go back to our patient, and we have our last question here. So remember, highly treatment experienced on a holding regimen that includes tenofovir. Though remember, tenofovir on phenotype anyway was shown to have still some activity. You now have both maraviroc and raltegravir approved and available to you. Etravirine may be available to you through expanded access and is likely, I think, to be approved in the next couple months or so. Our resistance summary, you remember that there's a fivefold increase in IC50 to darunavir. That is below the lower cutoff, so darunavir is likely to have full activity or nearly full activity. Tipranavir, however, the fold change was a little bit above 7, so tipranavir is not likely to have substantial activity. Zidovudine was just above the resistance cutoff. The patient is in infuvertide experienced, and the tropism assay in this particular patient shows dual mixed virus. So my last slide is our final question, which is, well, what are you going to do? So I'm going to send you out the poll, and you can vote. What regimen would you choose for this patient? And look at the choices carefully. So you could use raltegravir plus 2 or 3 nukes. You could use raltegravir plus darunavir plus 2 or 3 nukes. Raltegravir, darunavir, and infuvertide. Raltegravir, darunavir, and maraviroc. Or raltegravir, darunavir, and etravirine. And if you don't have etravirine available, you're actually going to choose to wait. So if any of you are still out there, go ahead and vote. And I think either I've done a good job or you guys didn't really need this talk. But basically, I think you got the message. About almost 30% of you would choose raltegravir, which would be fully active, darunavir, which would be fully active, and 2 or 3 NRTIs. And in this case, tenofovir is likely to have activity. 3TC or FTC probably has some residual activity. So I think that's a very reasonable choice. The majority of you, and I would fall in with the pink people, are going to use raltegravir, darunavir, and etravirine, even if it means waiting for etravirine. It may be kind of overkill. We may be adding, do we really need to add that third active agent? And there's no study that can answer that question right now. There's no data that I can point to say you must do this. But I think that the thing that concerns me a tiny bit is there are a couple darunavir resistance mutations. Again, the fold change is less than 10, which is the lower cutoff, but it's not 1, it's 7. So there is some decreased susceptibility to darunavir. If this were my patient, I would probably use darunavir, raltegravir, etravirine, and I would probably go with at least 2 nucleosides, tenofovir, FTC, or maybe even tossing in zidovudine. And you could argue, God, you're going to break the bank, Iran. Maybe that's a little bit too much. But I think if we undertreat, if we say, oh, well, I'll just go with a couple of active agents here plus nucleosides, the risk is that you'll, if you don't get the patient below detectable, they will select for integrase inhibitor resistance, and then your treatment options near will be quite limited. And I think that while there are drugs in development, there's elvitegravir, there's vicriviroc, those drugs are probably not going to add a lot to raltegravir and maraviroc. They'll add treatment options, but they're unlikely to salvage patients who fail raltegravir or maraviroc. So now I think we can open the questions. You guys can type in questions if you like, or I think the operator can open the line so you can ask questions if you like. There is a question. It reads, this afternoon, Dr. Bartlett suggested that maraviroc, even if used in mixed or R X4 tropic virus, shouldn't cause harm. He suggested that X4 tropism is the result of disease progression, not the cause. Do I agree? Well, I agree that when Maraviroc was given to patients that had X4 virus, we didn't see a dramatic fall in CD4 cell count. And in the MOTIVATE studies, those patients who had who didn't suppress, about two-thirds of them had emergence of X4 virus. And when that X4 virus emerged, those patients did not have a dramatic fall in CD4 cell count. So you didn't see this precipitous decline in CD4 cell count. So I think that Maraviroc didn't cause any harm in those patients. On the other hand, though, if you're counting on Maraviroc to be a fully active agent, and let's say you're pairing it up with raltegravir, unless the patient has R5 virus, Maraviroc is not going to have full activity. And while you might not cause any harm, if you don't get the antiviral activity of Maraviroc, you may end up leaving your raltegravir or darunavir essentially kind of out in the breeze and run the risk of selecting for integrase inhibitor resistance or further protease inhibitor resistance. And in terms of the second part of this question, does X4 virus, is it the result of disease progression or does it cause disease progression? I think the jury's still out on that one. I think it's different selecting for X4 with an R5 inhibitor than actually having X4 emerge. I'm not sure of the answer there. I don't think we have enough data yet. There's another question that just came in that asked, is it reasonable to use raltegravir after a triplet failure? I think that's also a good question. I think the kind of wimpy answer is, well, we don't have any data, so I don't really know. But I think the alternative answer is that if paired with appropriate active agents, it's likely that raltegravir will be a well-tolerated and very active second-line therapy. It has some advantages. There really are no negative lipid effects of raltegravir. On the other hand, there are some disadvantages, which is it's a twice-daily drug. It's not a once-daily drug. And I think given what we know about the pharmacokinetics, at least at this point, it's really going to stay a twice-daily drug until, in the foreseeable future. And while atazanavir boosts raltegravir levels to a modest degree, it really doesn't boost them enough to turn raltegravir into a once-daily drug. So I think it's reasonable to consider it, and you have to balance the kind of the risks and benefits. I didn't really talk about the side effect profile of raltegravir or Maraviroc or etravirine, but in the MOTIVATE studies, there really were very few differences between Maraviroc and placebo in terms of lab or clinical toxicity. Really the same for raltegravir. Very few differences between placebo and raltegravir in the benchmark studies. And in the DUET studies, the main problem was that etravirine is associated with a rash, though in general it's typically a mild rash. Then there's one more question that says, given the cost of the tropism assay, how would you recommend clinicians use Maraviroc in practice? And this probably should be our last question because we're running out of time. I really think at this point in time, Maraviroc is a drug that will be used predominantly in highly treatment-experienced patients where you really are trying your best to construct an active regimen in patients that have limited treatment options. I think while Maraviroc may be a useful drug kind of earlier in treatment in the treatment sequence, I think as yet we don't have data to fully support that. So I think that Maraviroc is predominantly going to be used in more advanced patients. Is it known whether raltegravir, etravirine, or Maraviroc cause fat accumulation or lipoatrophy? I don't think we have all the data yet on that. I don't know of specific kind of DEXA studies that have been carried out, it seems unlikely that they're going to be associated with either fat accumulation or lipoatrophy, but I don't think we have all the data yet to answer that question. So I think I better close now. I appreciate everybody taking time in their evening to listen to the talk, and I know you can also listen to it again online if you want, and I really appreciate your time. So thank you.
Thank you for listening. To take the post-test and receive CME CE credit, please visit the BodyPro's main activity page.